from Tuquito LLC. It's Keto Woman Podcast with Daisy Brackenhall.
Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight, after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. Keto has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman Podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs to 20 grams or less per day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein, scale to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalised keto. I'll be asking my guest each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history and so have access to the bigger picture. Thank you, Susie Edge, for supporting me and this podcast by making a pledge at my Patreon page. Do you want to hear your name here at the top of the show? Are you enjoying this podcast and would like to help me make more episodes? Then head to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It means a great deal to me, and you will get to headline the show just like Susie did today. This week's extraordinary woman is Lisa Bailey. Lisa is 51 years old and hails originally from Bournemouth in the south of England. She now lives in a small village in Aberdeenshire, Scotland, with her husband Nick and their menagerie of 2 labradoodles, 1 cat, 6 chickens, 1 cockerel, 5 ducks and a tank full of tropical fish. She is also the proud mum of 4 wonderful sons, all in their 20s. Lisa is a qualified personal trainer, naturopathic nutritionist and primal health coach, and you can find out more about her on her website lisabaileyhealth.com. She brings the essential combination of both nutrition and movement to her clients, and with her counselling and relaxation therapist qualifications, she also provides positive mindset coaching and relaxation therapies. Her new online kettlebell training program, The Kettlebell Cure, will be available later this year. Lisa aims to open up this kind of training to all ages and fitness levels because of the multitude of benefits it provides, from increasing lean muscle tissue, burning fat, improving bone density and joint mobility, and overall flexibility. Lisa and I had a few technical challenges recording this episode. We both live in the middle of nowhere, and Lisa had to record from her local village hall. Unfortunately, a local walking group and a children's gym class also decided to turn up on the same day, so there is a little bit of background noise in parts. I wanted to keep the original recording, so please bear with the odd background interference that crops up here and there. I'm really looking forward to trying out Lisa's kettlebell program, and will let you know how I get on. Welcome, Lisa, to the Keto Woman Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Daisy. Thank you for having me on. It's a privilege to be here.
This is our second attempt. We tried this last week and both had tech issues.
We did, yeah.
We're hoping everything's going to go smoothly today. I think it is. I've got a good feeling.
I hope so. It's the joys of living out in the countryside, as you said.
I was going to say, we both live out in the middle of nowhere, don't we? I'm in the middle of rural France and You're in the middle of Scotland.
I am, yes, in a very tiny little village in the middle of, well, just in the foothill of the Cairngorms, which is beautiful. But yes, we don't have great internet a lot of the time. So, yeah, fingers crossed for today.
Yes, but you still managed to have a thriving business, which we will find out about later. But let's start with you. Tell me a bit about your story.
My story is one of ill health, really. I was quite a sickly child. I had many, many bouts of very severe tonsillitis. When you think of tonsillitis, you don't think it's necessarily that bad or that big a deal, but I had very, very high fevers, delirium. It was really quite serious, and I had it very frequently. And it basically came to the point when I was 10, I had my tonsils taken out. But up until that point, I was very ill. I wasn't really good at eating. I didn't like foods very much. Because I had tonsillitis all the time, I had antibiotic after antibiotic. So, you know, I think that really wrecked my gut health. And I ended up with severe abdominal problems. You know, I had lots of constipation, lots of bloating, and just very, very uncomfortable all the time. And of course, in those days, there wasn't really all the awareness that there is today of things like gluten or anything like that. It was just, well, you know, you've got a bit of an upset tummy, or it might be something like IBS, but even IBS wasn't really that massively diagnosed in those days. So nothing was done. I would just, you know, had to kind of grin and bear it, really. So yeah, that was a bit difficult. When after I'd had the tonsillectomy, my appetite was a lot better, which is great. I was still very fussy, though. I didn't like anything, really, apart from eggs. So, you know, if I was staying with a family member because my parents were away, it was, what are we going to feed her? And it was like, well, just give her some boiled eggs. She'll be fine. So fortunately, eggs are really good. So that's lucky.
Yeah, exactly. But you must have had that association, I should imagine. If, you know, if you were in and out of tonsillitis all the time, eating must have physically been, you know, often painful, certainly difficult. And I know when I get it, because I get it fairly frequently, but you tend to feel really sick as well.
Yes, yeah, you do. And the appetite's not there. And also in the bouts, when I was really poorly, I had to have things like Complan. Now, I don't know if you ever had Complan. I don't even know if it still exists, but it was horrible. It was, you know, the only way that I could get any nutrients into me. But, oh, I really despised it. It was really revolting. Yeah.
So eating was just fraught, really, with not good things.
Yeah, eating was very fraught for me. It really was. You know, I had many times when it was basically eat your dinner or you won't have any pudding. And that was fine by me because I wasn't really fussed. So, you know, I just would push things around on my plate. I must have been a nightmare for my parents. But it was just, yeah, it was a trauma for me. I really just did not enjoy eating. I didn't enjoy food at all, really.
Did you have problems then as you were going through that period and in, you know, in a time of real growth, really? Did you have any side effects from not getting enough nourishment, basically?
Well, I'm guessing I probably did. Just, I mean, thankfully I did eat eggs, and eggs are very nutrient dense. I was quite skinny. I was quite a skinny child. So I don't think I had necessarily nutrient deficiencies, but that interestingly may have played a role in what happened as I grew older, because, you know, as I'll speak a little bit later on, you know, the nutrient density problem that I ended up having, a nutrient deficiency, ended up in some quite severe problems for me. You know, I went into my adolescence eating a lot better. And obviously, you know, there's plenty of sort of junky food and all the rest of it like we do. I wasn't massively drawn to that, but I was eating more healthily. But I was very, by this point, very into animal welfare, which I still am. And there's a lot of cancer in my family. So I was very concerned that, you know, with all the hype around red meat and all the things that we now know are disproved, that I, you know, I didn't want to get cancer, and I didn't want to get this, and I didn't want to get that. So I became a vegetarian as soon as I left home, which was age 16, 17. I became a vegetarian, and I was vegetarian for 27 years.
Wow, long time.
And I did it for all the, you know, I did it for all the right reasons, thinking that it was good for my health. And And again, in those times, which we still have, you know, we still have that whole grains are heart healthy and low fat and all the rest of it. So I was following that absolutely to the T, which meant that any dairy that I had was not that nutritious because I didn't particularly like milk. So I would have some cheese and some yogurt, but it was always low fat. So I wasn't getting the fat nutrients that I needed. And that was, you know, all the way through my pregnancies. I've had, four children, but three pregnancies. I've got twins. But interestingly, in every single pregnancy, I craved milk in the second trimester. I absolutely craved milk and I wasn't a milk drinker at all. So that clearly was a sign saying, you know, you are needing some, you know, fats and proteins and health. But again, it was low fat. So I probably wasn't getting what I should have been getting.
Mm.
And I was still having a lot of gut distress, you know, on and off over the years. I still was suffering with the gut health problems and the constipation and chronic pain and reflux. I'd had tests actually. I went for an endoscopy and I had a barium meal exam. And, you know, they couldn't find anything. There were no obstructions, there were no polyps, there was nothing, you know, obvious, which is good. But, you know, I was always left with no diagnosis, nothing at all, which obviously isn't terribly helpful when you're still suffering all the time. So I think my gut was in a real mess. I was vegetarian. I had my children very close together. And I think that just really wrecked my system. I think I was very, very nutrient deficient.
That's a lot of stress on your body in a period of time, isn't it? I mean, pregnancy really draws a lot from your body, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, I mean, I had, as I said, my children were pretty close together. I had my first son and then 3 years later I had my second. And then there's only 15 months between him and twins. So I was still breastfeeding him when I was pregnant with the twins. Which isn't very clever, really. So, you know, we really do need a bigger gap. You know, not that I would change anything. I've got wonderful sons, but, you know, it's not very efficient on the body. It draws all the time from you. And if you're not eating properly, then obviously that's going to have an impact. Absolutely.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if you go into pregnancy at the peak of your health, it still draws quite a lot and women suffer from things like hair loss and things, don't they? That shows a sort of down regulation a bit of the body's drawing back its energy for what it really needs. So if you're entering into that period not in peak health, you know, I can only imagine, like you say, doing it over and over, that's going to take its toll on your body, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is. And, you know, the interesting thing, which I didn't understand why at the time, and now I look back, I completely see it. When the twins were 6 months old, we moved from London, we moved to Scotland. And it was literally about 2 months later, I thought I was coming down with a cold. And nothing actually happened. I didn't get a cold, but I couldn't smell and I couldn't taste, which quite often can happen, you know, when you have got a cold. But that didn't rectify itself. I thought, well, that's really weird. So I went to the doctor and I said, I can't smell and I can't taste. And I thought I was getting a cold, but I haven't got one. What's going on? So she sent me for tests and they put a very, very long camera up my nasal passage, and I've only got a small nose, and had a good look around and couldn't find anything. You know, typically if you lose your sense of smell, it can be to do with polyps, which I didn't have. And they just had no answer for me. They said, well, it could be an allergy, you know, here, have a steroid spray. So I went away with this steroid spray and I used to have to hang upside down from a chair for 10 seconds to put it up my nose and stay there for a bit till it all went in. And it didn't really achieve very much. And I just thought, do I really want to be spraying steroids up my nose forever? Because who knows how long this is going to last? It doesn't seem to be doing very much. And the answer was no. So I didn't do that for very long and I just stopped using it. And my smell and taste was gone. It was really strange because I couldn't work out why. I couldn't work out what was going on. The only time, interestingly, that it came back in tiny little bursts was if I did get a cough or a cold. And I had, you know, if I was having mucus up my nose and you know, opposite to what normally happens when people have a cold and that dulls down, I could actually smell and taste. It would be even just maybe for a couple of hours.
How strange.
Yeah, it was really strange.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought, is it mold in the house? Is it this? Is it that? The things that I've gone through in my brain to try and work out why. We moved from Scotland to Tunisia and we lived there for 4 years with my husband's work. And that's a very different climate. It's a very dry heat. Didn't make any difference. And we moved from there to Oman for a further 4 years. And that's a very humid heat and it didn't make any difference. And I just guess I got used to it. People would say, oh, how can you enjoy food? But I guess I did. I just was so, it was texture was very important. And, you know, you just get on with it, really. I mean, I guess out of all the senses that you could lose, it's probably not the worst. You know, I can see and I can touch and I can hear. So you just get on with it and you just learn to live with it.
It's tricky, isn't it? I used to work with a lady who didn't have a sense of smell. And you know, you don't necessarily think of that straight away, but of course it impacts your taste and you have no taste. And she basically didn't really have any interest in food. I mean, she ate food was fuel and it didn't really matter. You know, you don't, in a way, in a small way, it's an advantage if you know, especially if you have a liking for foods that aren't healthy or good for you, because mm-hmm. you can just eat, because yes. you don't like them, but you can, yeah. so you can just eat, you know, this nutrient dense plate. But she said the same thing, that she looked for things like texture to get some kind of interest in her plate, for texture and colour.
Yeah, and things like curries, spices, yeah, because although I wouldn't have been able to tell you what the flavour was, it was interesting because it was spicy. Yeah, the sensations were really interesting. So things like mm. that were nice, you know, that you could enjoy food like that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I couldn't, if someone was making something, I couldn't smell it. So it wouldn't make, you know, you get hungry if you smell food, mm. but I didn't have that. So really, I would eat when I was hungry because I didn't have the other overriding sense sort of saying, oh, that smells good, maybe I should have some to eat. You know, that didn't kick in. So I guess that was quite useful in that sense. But yeah, it was really strange. And I came back, my husband and I, my ex-husband, I should say, we separated in 2005. And I came back in 2006 to the house in Scotland, where I'm still at. And I had a routine checkup with the doctor. And she said, oh, wow, it's been 10 years since you had your, you know, first exploratory exam. Do you fancy, you know, seeing again if you're not still smelling and tasting? And I said, yeah, let's do that, because technology's changed. And so I went and had another exam, and the consultant was, you know, he couldn't find anything. But what he did say was, your nasal passages are really dry. They are extremely dry, which they were. I never had to blow my nose, never had, you know, I was very rarely had colds anyway.
Oh, that makes sense with the mucus and cold thing. Ah, yes.
With the mucus, doesn't it? Yes. So I know, I said, well, he said, you need mucus to smell and taste. That's really important. I said, well, that's really interesting, because obviously I don't have that at all. But when I have a cold, I do. So he suggested using a saline spray, but I tried it, but it didn't do anything, because again, it's not mucus and it doesn't stay. It doesn't stay. And I think that was the same thing that I'd had previously with the steroid spray, is it wasn't, you know, although the moisture goes into your nose initially, it's not staying there. So it
that's always the problem,
isn't
it, with anything you take
yeah.
exogenously?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, never going to compare with an endogenous production.
It. Yeah. Exactly. Mm. So, you know, that for me was then, okay, I've got some kind of inkling as to why or what's
how
happening.
Can I make mucus?
How can I make mucus? How do I make mucus? So, you know, that set me on another journey. You know, when I came back from living abroad, I became a personal trainer. And that was really just the sort of a big transformation for me. It was just great. I absolutely loved it. I started off being a jazzercise instructor, actually. That's what got me on the road.
Jazz hands.
Jazzercise, jazz hands.
I remember that.
Yeah, I know. That was great fun. It was really good fun. A lovely community of girls that were doing that. But I kind of wanted more, and I was studying a lot more of you know, fitness and health. And I really wanted to do something of mine, I guess, and do more. And I wanted to be able to reach people one to one. So I did a personal training course and that was great. I sort of didn't look back from that really. And I stopped doing the jazzercise and I just worked for myself, first of all, as a one-to-one basis. And then I developed my own classes. So I currently teach three different classes a week. I do a cardio kickboxing class. I teach kettlebells and I also do a high intensity interval training class. And that was great. And along that, I then got really into nutrition. So I was really researching. And I think because of my own gut health, I was still searching for a reason as to why I was still suffering with stomach problems. You know, they were becoming a bit more frequent. And, you know, I couldn't work out why, but I was reading more about the paleo side of things. You know, I read Rob Wolf's book and I read Mark Sisson's Primal Blueprint. And I just thought, wow.
And where were you at this point? Were you still vegetarian at this point?
I was still vegetarian, yes. I was still vegetarian at this point.
Right.
And it really fascinated me and it really resonated with me because I thought this makes so much sense evolutionarily. It makes so much sense. Even though I was still vegetarian, I could see what they were saying and I could see how we developed our brains and, you know, how we were probably meant to eat meat. I did understand that. I did see that. I was also looking at the fact that, you know, things like grains and lectins that are in grains and gluten. And I just thought, wow, I wonder if that's what's the problem with my gut. I wonder if that, you know, if I've got a gluten intolerance or something. So I decided that I would take gluten out of my diet and try sort of a paleo type approach, but as a vegetarian. And that's actually really difficult because, you know, I think you can do it, but I was very active. You know, I was doing a lot of teaching classes and, you know, trying also to keep my own personal fitness, the things that I wanted to do. So I found that with removing a lot of the food groups that are necessarily within the paleo field, I was suddenly very lacking in protein because, you know, I'd previously eaten things like corn and, you know, and again, they're processed foods, so they're not great. So I'd taken all that out and I just was feeling very tired. I had a really quite a difficult adaptation phase. I felt really, really unwell first 2 to 3 weeks of starting the paleo, really unwell. You know, I had the whole low carb flu thing going on, even though I wasn't very low carb. I mean, I was eating, you know, sweet potatoes and I was eating, sort of some quinoa every now and then and maybe a little bit of rice. But I felt really bad. I had, you know, bad, nausea and just so tired, so, so tired. And still trying to keep doing my classes and things. And I kept thinking, I'm supposed to feel better. And kept researching, thinking, okay, there's a reason for this. And I was looking at the, you know, lots of forums and seeing that, okay, low carb flu, it must be that. And it's going to come better. It's going to come right. And of course it did. But I was still quite tired, energetic, you know, energy wise. I didn't feel very energetic. And I just thought, you know what? I'm not getting enough protein for the amount of exercise and what I'm doing. My protein levels have dropped drastically. And it was at that point that I thought, well, I think I'm going to have to make a big decision here and maybe put some meat in and maybe some fish and not beat myself up about it. Make sure that all my resourced food is going to be really good quality, high animal welfare. So I did. I didn't make a big deal of it. I didn't even tell my husband, the man that I'm married to now. He didn't know I was going to do it because I didn't want to make a big fanfare in case I decided that it didn't agree with me or I couldn't do it. So he was actually away and I got a little bit of chicken breast and I got a little bit of fish and I just had, you know, little bits and I thought, okay, that's okay. I feel all right. And actually it had a big impact on my energy almost immediately. It was amazing.
Wow, so that really showed it was the right thing to do.
It really showed that I was needing it. My body was needing it, definitely. And so gradually I upped the amount that I was having, and then I sort of made that little foray into some red meat, had some mince, had some, you know, little bits and pieces, until basically I was eating, you know, the whole range of different meats, you know, beef and lamb and some offal and just having it all. And the difference was just astounding in my health. As soon as I'd taken the gluten out, I didn't have any of the problems that I'd had with my gut at all anyway. I'd already, you know, knocked that on the head, which was brilliant. I mean, it was just like, wow, after all these years, that's what I needed to do. And then once I dialed in the, you know, taking in the meat and just upping my protein, the difference was astounding. It was really, really good. So that was fantastic. I was still having some dairy at that point, not an awful lot, but, you know, just little bits and pieces. And I felt a little bit like I had some lower, you know, abdominal issues with that. So I decided I was going to remove that for a while and just see how that went. And interestingly, at that point, I had about 6 weeks of intermittent smell and taste. And I just thought, wow, this is it. My smell and taste has come back. Oh my God, I've sorted everything out.
Yeah, it must have been exciting. Yeah.
But then it went just as quickly. It was gone.
Oh no.
What is that about? I mean, I just couldn't understand why. You know, I thought I dialed this in and everything was working. And it was so frustrating, I can't tell you, because to just get that little snippet back was so exciting, and then to have it whisked away again. But at the core of that, I understood that actually nothing was actually broken. Because when you've gone, I mean, it was 20 years. I had 20 years of not smelling and not tasting. And you kind of think at some point, well, something's obviously broken and that's it. So I had a little glimpse of, well, it might not be broken.
Oh, yes, that's very true. You just haven't quite found the right key.
Just haven't worked out what's going on here. So I thought maybe it was the dairy. And so I just kept that out, but that didn't make any difference because it had gone again. So yeah, it was all this tweaking and changing. And at that point, I then went, you know, really quite low carb. So I was having very minimal, no starchy carbs at all, and, you know, minimal amounts of sort of leafy greens and things like that. But I did get into, fermenting vegetables in a big way, actually. I did a lot of fermentation. I made sauerkraut and kimchi, and I made my own coconut milk yogurt, and, I did a lot of that. And I do think that that is very important if you're eating a certain type of diet. If you're eating a standard diet, or you're eating any diet that includes vegetables and fruit, that fermented foods are really, really helpful to help keep your gut bacteria in a, you know, a really healthy state.
Yes, I remember when I was interviewing Amber O'Hearn, actually, she was talking about that, and we had reader listener questions that came in, and someone asked about the importance of fermented foods. Mm. And she was saying she saw it almost as a supplement you needed if you were eating those kind of foods.
Yes, and I think that's very true.
You didn't need so much if you were eating carnivore the way she does.
Yes, I do think if you're eating a certain type of diet, that fermented foods are really important, because it helps to keep that healthy gut bacteria in check. And it's, you know, a valid thing to have in your diet. So I was doing a lot of that. I mean, I was fermenting everything in sight, pretty much. And I had got to the point where I was having lots and lots of veg. I didn't have any fruit. I wasn't having any fruit. I didn't have that for quite a long time. But loads of veg, loads of different greens and all that kind of thing. And, you know, platefuls.
Interesting point, actually, that I'd ask you about. That someone in my Facebook group, Georgette, was mentioning, because she's doing an elimination diet and trying to figure out different things with her health. And the person she's been seeing was talking about, he was getting her to test sulfur type foods. She was testing cauliflower, I think, and broccoli and different things. But she was saying that if you don't eat certain foods for a while, you kind of lose the things that are required in your gut to process those, and then when you reintroduce them, it can be a problem with digesting and give you stomach cramps and things. So, you know, I wonder how much you need to continue with things?
It can be, yes. It can be for a while. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the gut biome can change within one day. If you change your diet completely, it will change within one day. It's amazing.
Oh, very reactive.
Yeah, it's very reactive. But I think that you can reintroduce foods, you know, slowly, and your gut will, you know, it will adapt again. So I think with elimination diets, they're very useful because obviously you can identify what you really have a problem with. And then I think it's just a question of, you know, if you have a problem with it, do you really want to introduce it back in any way? Because likely you will have another problem with it. So is it something that you want to keep out of your diet or not? If it's something you want to reintroduce, then maybe little bits and seeing how that goes. And, you know, yes, there is a valid thinking that it may be more problematic. But then I think if you have a problem with it, you have a problem with it. So, you know, I was eating loads and loads. I wasn't seeing any issues with that. But I wasn't also seeing massive benefits either, you know, and you know, you kind of think, well, is this doing great things? Or, you know, certainly my gut was fine because I was not having any more issues with anything because I wasn't having gluten, but I still wasn't smelling or tasting or anything like that. I was fine. I was in good health. But it was really interesting around that time. This was last October. I'd started reading a lot about, you know, the Inuits and Willemer Stefansson and his experiences in the early 1900s living with the Inuit and eating a meat-only diet. And I just thought, wow, that is really interesting, because we're so brought up with you've got to have your, certainly your veggies, but you've got to have your fruit and veggies and all your fiber and all of that. And I just thought, that's incredible. And he kept saying he was in the best health. And I then read some more books. I read Stephen Donaldson's book, which is called Strong Medicine. And he was healing people with all sorts of problems, obesity, type 2 diabetes, arthritis, with a mainly meat and fat diet. And again, this was in the 1930s, I think, 1930s, 1950s. So interesting. I mean, wow. I just thought, why is this not known? Why aren't people talking about this in the mainstream? Because this is amazing. And there were other doctors that were doing the same thing. So then I was looking, you know, on places like Twitter and Facebook, and I found people like Georgia Ead and Amber O'Hearn and the Andersons, who had all been eating meat and fat for a long time. And obviously Georgia Ead talking about the problems, the anti-nutrients that are in vegetables. And I just found it so fascinating. And I thought, maybe this is not what we think it is. Maybe we've just been, not hoodwinked, but, you know, we've been sold something that isn't necessarily true and isn't necessarily valid for everybody. So I said to my husband last October, I'm going to try a month of not eating vegetables. The fruits, as I said, wasn't an issue because I wasn't eating any anyway. And he was like, oh, okay, well, okay. So I did. And initially it wasn't difficult. It was just psychologically weird because we're so ingrained to have those vegetables on our plate. So we would sit down to the same meal, except he had vegetables and I didn't. And it was just odd, you know, that odd feeling. But it wasn't long, you know, a week or two, and I was completely used to it. But the really interesting thing was that 3 weeks in, my smell and taste came back.
Wow.
And I just thought, okay, this is very interesting. I was excited, but trying not to be, because I'd already had that, you know, I'd had it on and off for 6 weeks a couple of years before. So I thought, well, I'm not going to get overexcited because I don't know how long this is going to be. And I'll just enjoy it while I've got it. That's fine. Just enjoy it while I've got it. And here I am 10 months later, and I've been able to smell and taste every single day since then. It's just phenomenal.
Wow.
It's amazing. And even now, one of the first things I do when I wake up, I go to brush my teeth and I smell my little pot of coconut oil toothpaste. And when I go to bed, I smell it. And it's just like a habit now. I can still smell. I can't believe it. It's just amazing to me. It really is. But then when I look at it in a very objective way, I think, well, I do have now mucus. I do have, you know, I have to blow my nose occasionally. And I think I was so nutrient deficient when I was, you know, 27 years of vegetarian, having all my children very close together, having real gut permeability with the gluten, you know, and all the antibiotics that I'd had, it's not really that surprising that something was going to kick off in my body. And for me, that was obviously the smell and taste. For someone else, it might have been, you know, something else, or arthritis, or it could have been anything. But that was obviously for me what happened when I was nutrient deficient. And I think that my body had a little taste when I put the meat and fish back in my diet of, ooh, here's some real nutrients, look. But there was obviously something still blocking that, which I find really fascinating. I'm sure, you know, somebody like Georgia Ead would find that really interesting, because there was something, you know, and I wasn't eating a massive load of vegetables. By the time I'd taken them out, I wasn't eating platefuls like I had before. I was much more sort of more on a keto type diet with very minimal greens. So it wasn't like I'd gone from one extreme to the other. So there was obviously just something still minimally in my diet that was blocking absorption completely.
I'm wondering, is that the case? Or is there also potentially maybe just a factor of time? I'm just wondering, with that brief period you had when it came back, is almost like it's sort of starting to work a bit again, and then after a bit more time with building up the nutrient levels, I just wonder, being objective, whether there was still something blocking it. Maybe it was just a bit more time. I suppose the only way you could test it would be to
put it back in, but I'm too scared to do that because I don't want to lose it.
Yes, exactly. I can completely understand that. Yeah. It doesn't matter really, in a way, does it? It doesn't really matter. It works, so.
And it doesn't matter, because I'm absolutely, yeah, it works, and I'm really happy. I feel really healthy. I feel great on it. I really do. I enjoy my food. I know a lot of people say on a carnivore diet, oh, it must be so boring because you can only eat meat. But, you know, it's more than that. It's meat. It's different meats. I get excited and interested in what meat I'm going to have. Am I going to have beef? Am I going to have lamb? Am I going to have pork? I don't eat a lot of chicken because I don't think it's as nutrient dense. I have salmon. I eat offal. I eat heart, liver, kidney. Sometimes I have some brain. And just those choices alone are enough. You know, we seem to have this idea that we must have this massive diversity of food and we need to have a wide choice. But that choice is enough for me. And it's great. You know, I love it. And I think as long as you're getting the right nutrients and you're varying it, I mean, not necessarily sticking to one thing all the time, although that works for some people and that's fine. For me, it works really, really well. And I really enjoy it. I enjoy my food. I don't, you know, I eat once, maybe twice a day, and that's great. It's very satiating. It's very nutritious. And I really love it. Yeah, it's great. I can't see me changing.
It's quite a change, isn't it? From vegetarian to carnivore.
It's massive, from a vegetarian to a carnivore. I know. Who would have thought? My family, you know, my parents and my children, you know, they're all like, I just can't believe this was you years ago and this is you now. And it's true. Although my main principles are the same, because I still very much believe in animal welfare, and I always buy my meat, you know, from very good quality, either grass fed if I can get it, or, I mean, locally here we're very lucky. You know, I live in the middle of nowhere. It's all grass managed cows and, you know, sheep, and it's amazing quality. I'm very lucky. So that's really important to me. I think, you know, choosing high welfare, grass fed organic if you can, and if you can afford it. You know, I'm lucky I'm in a position where that I can, and I do. I understand it can be difficult for some people. I think you have to just do the best you can. But for me, those principles were really important, and I stick to those. And it was always about health. You know, I thought I was doing the right thing when I was a vegetarian. I thought that I was doing, you know, all the things I should be doing. And it's only when you research and you learn more that you can, hopefully with an open mind, you can embrace different things. And while it seems like a massive turnaround, it's because I've learned so much. I have learned and read and researched so much over the years. And it just makes such complete sense to me. we lived for millions of years like this. Why do we suddenly need to change it? And we've gone so far away from our primal needs, as it were, that, you know, all the processed foods that we have today is just unbelievably ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it's no wonder that we have, you know, the chronic conditions that we have, because we're feeding ourselves with food that we should never be eating. We are an animal and we should not be eating the things that we do. It's no wonder that our bodies are going to react.
Exactly. I was talking to some gardening clients of mine yesterday. Who's she's been a type 2 diabetic for a while, but she's recently started having to inject insulin, which of course I'm not happy about. I've been trying to persuade her to go low carb for ages. But I was just talking to her a bit more about it. They were, you know, they were interested in it, and I was discussing things. They're in their 80s. So it was quite easy for me to say, you know, remember how you used to eat. Remember your parents used to eat. And I was telling them about things like, you know, I have bacon and eggs for breakfast every day. And I said, it also appeals to my desire not to waste things. So I said, I cook my bacon in the oven, and then that bacon grease goes into a jar that I used to cook for other things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, she said, you know, my mother always used to do that. She always used to have a jar of dripping and bacon grease in the fridge that she used for things. So sometimes I think it's just about trying to stir the right emotions in people
to
get them interested.
Exactly.
She was, you know, well, I could do that. And I said, look, you know, and you cook from scratch every day. So little by little, I think she might be getting a bit interested.
Oh, but, that's great news.
Yes, you're right. It's only very recent, isn't it, that we've had all these overly processed and refined foods, and it's no wonder they're a problem.
Yeah, it's no wonder that we've got the problems we have. And I understand people have their own preferences. People want to be vegetarian and want to be vegan. I've been there. I know what that feels like. But I do worry that that agenda is being pushed onto the world as, you know, as a whole, as a global thing, that we should all be doing that, because I really don't think we should. And I worry that, you know, trying to now make processed burgers from stem cells or processed burgers from, you know, vegan sources is just another step in that same direction. But we are leaving behind what we are truly supposed to be eating if we do that. And I worry about that. I worry for the future, for my kids and their kids. And I really hope that doesn't happen. You know, what kind of planet are we going to live on if we don't have the ruminants and we don't have, you know, that regeneration and the circle of life? We have to have that. You know, death is a part of life, whether it's through vegan type of eating or a carnivore type of eating. It is part of the process, and we can't hide from that, and we shouldn't hide from that. And perhaps what we need to do is embrace it. And in the way, I don't mean embrace all, you know, animals being slaughtered under a tractor. I mean, you know, be thankful for the food that we have. And, you know, when you look at tribal type of eating, and then they kill the animal and they have a ceremony and they're thankful for the fact that they've got this animal. And, you know, we've lost so much of that. And I don't mean that in a religious sense. I mean it in a very personal, primal kind of way, a human way of being thankful that we have these things, and, you know, that we're able to eat as wholesomely as we can. And, you know, I think it's really important to be part of that cycle of life, you know, and embrace that. It's what we're all about, after all. It really is. We've just stepped so far away from it.
Exactly. And just respectful as well, I think, respectful of the animals.
Respectful, yes, absolutely. Having respect, yeah, definitely. You know, I don't like the whole factory farming thing at all. And I think if we can move away and help real farmers, you know, give the subsidies that are going to soy, give them to the farmers that are trying to do grass-fed, you know, products, let's help them. Let's really put the money where it's really going to be worthwhile. And, you know, maybe we'll see some changes there. That would be really fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen some other improvements in your health, haven't you? You had problems with your back and an Achilles injury, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, I have. I mean, and again, I think it's partly to do with the fitness that I've done, and a lot to do with my nutrition. I'd injured my back actually before I had children. I used to have a little mini when I lived in London, and it was a very cold winter and my battery kept getting flat. And I don't know if you know, with minis, the battery is in the boot. So I used to have to take the battery out every evening and charge it up in my kitchen and put it back in the morning to go to work. And just one day I happened to slip on the ice while I was lifting, twisted, and my sacroiliac joint was, oh, it was in so much pain. So that was me out of work for about 3 weeks. And, you know, for years after that, I just really suffered with my back so badly. It was just never right. And of course, then I had the children. So being pregnant and lifting and carrying babies and bending and, you know, you try to do the best that you can, but, you know, if a child is crying, you're just going to run and pick it up. You're not going to think, oh, I must bend in this way and I must do that. You just naturally go and pick the baby up. But I think also I was trying to do certain types of exercise and home videos and things like that, sort of quite Pilates based, in an effort to try and improve my core strength. But I found it really hard going. I didn't seem to be able to improve a lot. And I'd had a cesarean with the twins, so I guess that didn't help because the core muscles were cut anyway. And it was only when I'd qualified as a personal trainer, so that's many years later when I'd come back here and qualified as a personal trainer in 2009, that I started looking at things like kettlebells and learning about kettlebell training. And once I started doing that, the difference in my core strength and the difference in my back was unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah, it absolutely transformed it, because kettlebells are all about the core. You know, you can use your legs, you use your arms, you use everything. But the main benefit of kettlebell training is core strength. And wow, it really does. And if you've got a strong core, your back health is really good.
Oh, I need to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
Because I do have a kettlebell.
Oh,
it's
good.
Used as the doorstop.
Love it. But that's good, because it means you see it every day and you could just pass it and do a few swings and then put it back at the door. See, that's quite good visually. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. A lot of people, you know, we have equipment and what have you, but they don't know how to use it or they don't use it. In fact, I'm developing at the moment, I'm almost there with it, an online video beginner's course for kettlebells, and I'm calling it the kettlebell cure, because I do think it cures so many ills physically. It's so good for you. You know, things like, I know with customers that do my classes or clients that I've had, pelvic floor muscles, you know, abdominal strength, you know, just so many things. And as I said, back health. And I do think it's an amazing tool if it's used correctly. I think the problem is that we see a lot of, you know, YouTube videos or things in magazines, and you can't either see what they're doing properly or they're doing it wrong. And, you know, that's when you're going to obviously, people are going to have injuries. So for me, I think it's really important to educate people how to use it properly. And I really want to target this for, you know, men and women that have never picked up a kettlebell before and really don't know what to do with it, to really start from the beginning. And I really hope that it'll be, you know, well received, because I think it's a bit of a gap in the market. You know, I'm 51 and my health and fitness has never been better. And a lot of that is to do with my kettlebell training, for sure. And I do high intensity stuff as well. But, you know, my back health was massively improved, as was, and I think you were referring to this before, I have a torn meniscus in my right knee. And I was struggling with movement from my foot, actually, and into my knee about a year and a half ago. And even walking my dogs in the woods was absolutely excruciating. And all the high intensity stuff that I was doing, I had to modify for myself when I was teaching the classes, because I just couldn't do it. The only thing I could still do was my kettlebell training. And amazingly, every single time I did a class or was doing stuff at home, my knee felt so good. And I worked out that it was because it was really helping to drain my, you know, the lymphatic system. And I had a buildup of fluid behind the knee in a cyst. And every time I did kettlebells, it dispersed it. So the pain just kept going. It was really, really great. Mm. So that was the one thing that I could still keep doing. So I added in a lot more at that time, a lot more kettlebell training. And then I was doing things like eating a lot of bone broth and adding collagen. And, you know, fast forward to a year and a half later, and I've obviously changed to the carnivore diet, my knee is unbelievable. I'm running again. I can do all the high intensity stuff. I have no pain. My squats are really better than they've ever been. It's just amazing. I feel great. So I know that you can rehabilitate things. You just have to be doing the right thing. I think you have to be eating the right way, making sure that your foods are nutrient dense, and doing the right kind of exercise that's going to strengthen everything and, you know, build strength around the problem. So that's, you know, I try and help people a lot with things like that. I do think it's really, really important to not give up, because it could have been so easy to just say, oh, well, that's it. I've got a torn meniscus. I'm never going to be able to do anything again. But that's not the case. You know, it really isn't.
I suppose it was a good motivation, you know, with being that's what you do as a
exactly.
as a trainer and having your classes.
Yeah.
How have you found the changes in your approach to nutrition and what you've learned for that? How has that impacted your fitness business?
It's impacted it in the sense that I constantly read, as much as I can. I'm very, very interested in what's going on. I'm not closed-minded. I mean, I certainly don't advocate a carnivore diet to every client that comes through my door by any means. You know, I'm still a very individualized approach. You know, this works for me. It works really well for me. I've got another client who it's working incredibly well for as well. She then went on to have a consultation with paleomedicina, who are based in Hungary, and she has MS, and the differences in her is just phenomenal. She was already seeing benefits when she'd started my carnivore program, because it's one of the programs I now have within my nutritional programs to help people transition if they want to. And she was doing really well on that. But when she then went to paleomedicina, she had to then be really in strict ketosis and have the right ratios and have all, you know, her bloods done. And that was really important. And honestly, it's incredible that her energy levels, she's back doing things like swinging kettlebells again. And I mean, she's in her late 60s, and it's just the difference is phenomenal. It's brilliant to see. But, you know, I have other clients that are never going to want to do that. And that's absolutely fine. I wouldn't expect them to. Everybody's individual. I think a lot of the people that I see mostly are needing to step away from the processed foods, step away from the low-fat dogma, step away from the vegetable oils. That's a massive thing. And just helping them transition from that can be hard enough. I do have a lot of people who do extremely well on a low-carb diet. But again, they need a lot of help. So undertaking a program to help them do that is really important, because, you know, I'm there for support. It's very structured. I give them recipes. I give them, you know, sample stuff. They have tracking sheets. And it means that they've got a really supported way of doing it. So that if something, you know, if they are suffering from low carb flu type symptoms, it's not like I was on my own. I you know, kept having to research things. They've got a lot of support with that, which I think is really important. You know, and there's other people that come with issues that look like food intolerances. I mean, I'm a qualified naturopathic nutritionist, so I can look at what they're eating and their symptoms, say, well, I think it's this and I think it's that. So let's do an elimination diet. Let's look at this. Let's take that out and see what happens. So things are very individual. I, you know, I make sure that, it's individualized, and the same with my fitness too. You know, if I do a lot of one-to-one personal training, and again, that's going to be really directed at what the person is looking to achieve and what their fitness levels are at the moment, what, you know, whether they've got any injuries. I always do a fitness assessment before I start with somebody so that I can really see anything that might be a problem. And then we go through a program together so that they can really get the joy of fitness. I think that's really important, because that's so much of the motivational problems that people have, is that they haven't found something that they like, or they go to the gym, they don't know what to do, they feel intimidated at a gym, sometimes they can't get to classes because they've got young kids. You know, there's all these different things, and I think if they can be educated in a sense of finding different tools that will work for them. Maybe it's a kettlebell. Maybe it's a suspension trainer. Maybe it's, you know, all different things, and find the joy in that, achieve something and feel fitter and feel healthier. You know, that's my goal with people really. And I, that's what I strive to do. I do online fitness as well with people.
I was going to ask you that. Is it mostly face to face people you see locally, or work online too?
I do a lot. Yeah. I do a lot of face to face, but obviously as you mentioned, I live in a very small area, and amazingly, I'm pretty steady with business, which is great. But I do some online programs as well. And that's fine because you can get, obviously, you get information from the client and their level of fitness and what they've got, what they want to do. And you can design a program. I think what I miss from that is that real one-to-one sense of achievement, because you don't always hear back. You don't always, you know, I try and follow up as much as I can, but people go off and they do their thing and they live far away, and you don't always get that feedback. And I do miss that. That's one thing that with the online that I do miss. You know, it's nice with my, I have an online fasting program, and with part of that program, there's a private Facebook group. And that's really nice because I post in there every day. They get workouts and recipes and science articles and things to keep them motivated after the program itself has finished, so that they're still carrying on with their fasting, that they're still interested. And it's really great because people interact with each other on it, and they're really motivating each other, and you hear all sorts of things. I've had a couple of them that have done a 3-day extended fast together, and they've told everybody about how that went and made sure that I've been in the loop, so that if they need any extra info and help, you know, it's really nice. I do really like that, the feedback that you get with working with people. That's really important to me. I want to know that what I'm doing is successful for people. I want to know that they're happy and that their health has improved. You know, that's part of why I do it. I don't just roll out a program and not care. I want to know that somebody's benefiting. And if they're not, what I can do to help them. You know, that's really, really part of what I do. It's really important to me.
Yes, exactly. And that community and the support group atmosphere is important, isn't it?
Definitely.
It's been fascinating hearing about the multifaceted side to your business and all the things you get up to. Perhaps you could leave us with a top tip.
Yeah, my top tip really would be that health doesn't have an end date. I think that's, you know, so important to remember, because so often, you know, people they sign up for a program, or they go to the gym, or is something in January, and it's like a short-lived kind of goal that they're going to achieve in 6 weeks. You know, we see all the adverts all the time, get your six pack in 6 weeks and things like that. And it's like, well, after that, what I go back to doing the same old thing. It's like you see people that start some kind of diet. The whole idea is that then they will go back to eating in quotes normally. Well, what does that really mean? You know, the normally should be actually what the lifestyle change is. It's about your lifestyle. Health is forever. It doesn't have an end date, and we should be looking at being in it for the long haul. And that to me is trying to help people to really get to that point, because that's what we want ultimately is health forever.
Yes, I think that's a fantastic tip. And it's, you know, sometimes we just need to change that direction ever so slowly, you know, like those big cruiser ships that you can't just do a U-turn. They have to change really slowly, don't they?
Yeah, definitely.
But it's something that sticks, something that, like you say, stays forever.
Yeah, it stays. And I think, you know, for me, that's why education for myself, but also for my clients, is really important. I want people to understand what happens when you put food in your mouth, what happens when you're doing certain exercise. You know, I think if you understand what's going on, it really helps you to stay motivated, and it really helps you to make that whole lifestyle choice forever, because you get it. You know, that's the point. It's about understanding and education, and that to me is really important.
Yes, exactly. It's been fantastic hearing about all this, and certainly given me plenty to think about, and to maybe do some different things with that doorstop of
yes,
mine.
Definitely. Well, you know where to come if you need some help starting.
I do. And I don't know whether you're going to have the links for your new kettlebell course by the time this comes out. But if you don't, we will be adding those back into the show notes a bit later on, so people will be able to find that.
Perfect. Oh, that will be great. Thank you.
As I'm sure people are going to be very interested in that program. I certainly am.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Lisa. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. And yes, thanks, Daisy.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. It's thanks to the two keto dudes that I'm hosting this podcast. So please consider heading to their Patreon page at patreon.2keto.com and help them bring you more podcasts like this one. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on iTunes and Facebook. Every star and review really does help. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is from Robert Urich. A healthy outside starts from the inside. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.